Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Lara on WNYC, live in the green space today. And listeners, when we're in the green space, you can watch The Brian Lara Show as well as listen, because we stream live video. You can get it at WNYC.org. You can get it on our Facebook page. That is, that's WNYC's Facebook page, or the green space. .org, that's green with an E at the end, thegreenspace.org, or WNYC's Facebook page, or it's probably streaming right on the homepage at WNYC.org if you want to watch live streaming video of our show today. And for American households, there is probably no face or voice in American journalism more recognizable than those of our next guest. Katie Couric is America's anchorwoman, an award-winning journalist who broke the glass ceiling for women in network news, among many other things that she has done. In a new docuseries, America Inside Out, produced with National Geographic for the National Geographic Channel, Couric journeys through dozens of towns and cities, talking to people one-on-one, and is focused on, this is a tough assignment that you took on, Katie.
I know,
you focus
I'm crazy.
On heated and divisive topics. Welcome back to WNYC.
Nice to see you, Brian. I wore a green dress for the green space.
A
very
gentle,
green. It's gentle, like a highlighter green.
That's right. A gentle, bright kind of lime. You said it better than me. Highlighter green. Katie Couric, correspondent and executive producer of America Inside Out. And you dive into some really controversial conversations. There's an episode on white anxiety. One is called The Muslim Next Door. One episode, you explore the world of robot dating and gender inequality, among other things. We'll get to the robot dating, but how did you settle?
Confederate iconography and the whole debate over Confederate statues. And as someone who loves history and went to the University of Virginia and was in Charlottesville for that horrendous rally last August, that's one that's particularly near and dear to my heart as well.
So you went back there, and did you learn anything new about Charlottesville or that whole series of incidents that has not already been well digested by anybody and, you know, divided them up into their camps?
Yeah, I mean, I learned a lot in exploring sort of this whole notion of how we commemorate history and what historical figures we choose to idolize or we have chosen to idolize throughout history. And of course, I talked to the 16-year-old high school student who started the petition to take down the Robert E. Lee statue in the middle of Charlottesville. And I talked to Don Gathers, who started the Black Lives Matter movement in Charlottesville, as well as history professors who are experts on the Civil War. And I learned a tremendous amount. You know, it's embarrassing for me. I was an American Studies major, Brian, and there's so much about the Civil War and American history that I realized I wasn't taught, and I think many people in this room and listeners were not taught, and that is, you know, this whole notion of the lost cause narrative that romanticizes the Confederacy and disputes the notion that slavery was at the heart of the Civil War, and how that, through popular culture and movies like Gone with the Wind, has had a tremendous hold on the psyche of so many Americans. The fact that many of these Confederate monuments and memorials were placed at the height of the Jim Crow era. The Southern Poverty Law Center did a big survey, and many of them were put in the early 1900s and 1920, including the one in Charlottesville. The Robert E. Lee statue was placed after a KKK rally had taken place, and Birth of a Nation was showing in the local Charlottesville movie theater. And of course, many schools were named after Confederate icons, quote unquote, after Brown v. Board of Education as an affront to African Americans in this country. And when I tell my friends who feel very strongly that the statue should remain in public spaces, and I give them more historical context and perspective, oftentimes they say, gee, I never thought of it that way, or I never knew that. And this really was the purpose of this this series is to give people greater context and perspective on these very incendiary issues that people have strong knee-jerk reactions to and can spout whatever they want to on social media and act with authority. But really, when it comes down to it, people have opinions without much portfolio. So I wanted to provide the information they would need. And if they have the same opinion, that's fine. But at least it will be an informed opinion.
Now, tomorrow, I believe, is the final episode in the series.
Yeah. Right?
Called The Age of Outrage.
Right.
And you look at what some people call PC culture on college campuses, but I think it's a really interesting take to frame it in terms of outrage. So what did you go looking for it? What did you find?
Well, you know, I just thought it was so interesting how we're looking at the world quite differently. You know, I have a daughter who's graduating from college next month. I have another daughter who's 26. And I saw this very strong shift in how we look at different cultures, whether it's, you know, and all this new lingo that wasn't around, you know, in the dark ages when I was in college. When you think about things like safe spaces, trigger warnings, microaggressions, terms like white privilege or cultural appropriation. I thought, gee, this is a very different way of sort of relating to the world and relating to popular culture. And I wanted to better understand it. So I went to Northwestern and the University of Chicago, where they have very distinct, very differing points of view in terms of how they approach these things. Morty Shapiro, who's the president of Northwestern, who I knew because I gave the commencement address at Williams, where he was president before Northwestern, said you have to be comfortable to engage in uncomfortable learning. Whereas Robert Zimmer, the president of the University of Chicago, feels very strongly that we do not have intellectual safe spaces, microaggressions, trigger warnings, and there's no platforming. And so no platforming is when a speaker gets drowned out or unable to speak at a college or university. So these were all kind of complicated, thorny issues, and I just kind of wanted to get underneath the surface of all these things and give people the information about sort of how two different colleges are reacting. But in addition to that, Brian, I talked about cultural appropriation and fashion, for example.
Let me cut in only because
sure.
We have a clip from exactly that section.
Oh, okay. Perfect.
So which school were Joe and Elaine at? Do you remember?
Okay. Elaine Welteroth was the editor of Teen Vogue. And she is sort of, I think, a national expert, if you will, on cultural appropriation. And was trying to explain why when sort of fashion designers and other people take sort of imagery or customs from other cultures, co-opt them and claim them as their own, why that is so offensive to marginalized communities.
All right. So this is a dialogue between two people, including her, on
oh,
this.
And Josie is a fashion writer and editor. Josie, sorry. And Joe thinks it's sort of been taken too far. And it was very interesting, by the way, to see this play out at the Met Gala. You know, I wondered why more Catholics weren't up in arms about this, because if you're talking about cultural appropriation, I mean, that was sort of a case study in cultural appropriation.
Remind me, what happened?
Were they all dressed in sort of Catholic garb or sort of, you know, with a lot of sort of religious imagery based. I haven't seen the exhibit yet, and I wasn't at the Met Ball, but it was very, very religious sort of imagery in the outfits. It was crazy, you know, like Sarah Jessica Parker wore a nativity scene on her head, and there were a lot of sort of very saintly-looking headgear situations.
So in this clip, Joe speaks first, Elaine speaks second.
If we start to put the label on top of everything, because yes, we can definitely dig and find appropriation in almost everything, we're going to lose the creativity of what this industry is about.
You've seen Miley Cyrus come out in gold teeth and cornrows, and she's twerking on a stage, and suddenly that goes viral, and it's something that seems cool, and that's something that is being borrowed from a culture that has been oppressed and marginalized for generations. We have to examine why something becomes valid when a white person deems it wearable.
So we'll hear those clips in tomorrow night's show.
That's right. And hopefully this series will have a long tail. If people miss it, tomorrow it's on Hulu and it's on YouTube and Apple Television and Facebook and everywhere else you can imagine. Because, you know, it's been great. The people who have watched it it's designed to be a conversation starter too, to be able to continue the discussion. But I thought that, you know, that's just an interesting example of something that people often feel very strongly about, which is this whole idea of cultural appropriation. But to have someone like Elaine explain that, you know, that fashion, for example, has traditionally cut itself off from minorities and not really had, there hasn't been an equal opportunity or a seat at the table for many minorities. And what her point is, when white people then start wearing certain fashions, they become beautiful and valid and acceptable and, as she said, wearable, where it's been part of Black culture and not considered that way and looked at very differently. So, you know, this is very eye-opening conversations. My husband thinks the series may be too smart, but I don't think so.
And control room, we're going to go ahead to clip 3. See, this is the kind of behind the scenes thing that when we're not in the green space, I could just say in an intercom, but I don't have that luxury here. So we're going to
The transparency, Brian.
We're going to go to clip 3 in a second, because as if that conversation about appropriation wasn't fraught enough, you sat down and had dinner with some extremely controversial people on race and gender issues, people some believe shouldn't be given a platform. You interviewed Charles Murray, author of The Bell Curve, which suggested in that book back in the 90s that Black people are less intelligent on average. Jordan Kessler, the white nationalist leader behind the Charlottesville white nationalist rally, as you said before, and former Google employee James Damore, who wrote the Google Manifesto, so-called, which claimed that gender pay gap is a myth. So here's a little excerpt of your conversation with James Damore. He speaks first.
I assume that all of that gap is due to discrimination against women, when some of it may be due to simply them not being interested as much as men on average are.
People went crazy over your manifesto, right, to say the least, and they found it incredibly offensive, suggesting that women didn't have the capacity to excel in science, engineering.
Right. So I never talked about capabilities or aptitude. It was really about preference. They assume that there is this bias against women, and so they try to correct for it. But in some cases, they may overcorrect.
So this conversation really takes place on two levels. One is the content that you're talking to him about. The other is the concept of no platforming. And should people like him or Charles Murray even be given a platform to have a conversation with Katie Couric on national television, right?
Oh, well, I have no problem trying to understand a controversial figure and where they're coming from. So I think if we shut those people out and not hear their point of view, and I guess that's the argument against no platforming too, that, you know, if, you know, I think it's really hard when you talk about people with really repugnant views, you know, would you invite Adolf Hitler to a college campus, for example,
back
in the
Murray's
day?
Charles Murray's theory that
Well, you know, Charles Murray is a very interesting case, because I agree. I think what is the line between free speech and hate speech? But Charles Murray has also written extensively about class and society and socioeconomic issues. And I guess one could argue, should he be allowed to talk about that one paragraph in The Bell Curve and be challenged and have a debate on campus about this? And I talked to a Black PhD student at the University of Michigan. We feature him in the hour. And he said that the problem is Charles Murray's philosophy has been co-opted by white supremacists and used to spread racism all across the country. And that's why he didn't know platform him, Charles Murray, when he went to Michigan, but he did challenge him on stage. So it's even Morty Shapiro believes that controversial figures should be allowed to speak and that there could be silent protests or a very spirited debate afterwards. But, you know, I really don't come down on one side or the other. I basically show both positions and let viewers figure out where they stand on it.
One more from the series, very much on the lighter side from what we've been talking about so far, the episode Your Brain on Tech. And you say you actually went on a date with a female robot and a male robot. What does that
really
even mean?
I didn't really go on a date. I mean, I think that basically I went to this sex robot factory. I think actually my guy is on the cover of New York Magazine, and he's obviously two-timing me because he went on a date with a New York Magazine writer. I was very upset when I heard that. No, you know, but that whole hour is on. It asks the question, is technology robbing us of our essential humanity? You know, in terms of our relationship with technology, our complete, obsession, which I have. I have a real problem with this, with our smartphones, and whether or not it's going to affect every aspect of our lives, or how is it affecting every aspect of our lives. And I kind of go through the hour talking about how technology increasingly is taking over. I interviewed some people who had a chip put in their hands in Fall River, Wisconsin, this company where they can open doors and turn on lights and pay for things from the vending machine. And sort of this merging of man and machine was very interesting to me. And I talked to the guy who's head of the virtual reality lab at Stanford, where, you know, increasingly, especially in Asia, men are having relationships like Her, like that movie Her with Joaquin Phoenix, where they have relationships with their devices. And so I thought, well, let's take it a step further. And there was this sex doll factory near San Diego where they all look like porn stars, which of course is something really weird and maybe should be considered when we think about this. And they're made of silicone, and they now are being equipped with AI. So you can talk to them, and they can have conversations. And I'm sure Please Take Out the Garbage isn't part of their dialogue. But I interviewed a man who had four of these dolls and was waiting for the latest one, Harmony, because she is equipped with AI. It is super, super weird. What can I say? And you can have them tailor-made. They had all these different nipple sizes. Some look like Frisbees, some didn't, all different colors. You can do all the, you know, the cosmetics of the doll. It was super weird. And they're $20,000 a piece, which is crazy to me. But do you have a clip from that?
I don't think we have a clip
from
that.
Okay, good.
People will just
anyway,
have to.
I sort of had fun with it, and I had a conversation with a couple of them. And it was just very bizarre with the dolls. Yeah, you can sit with them and talk to them. And Henry, the doll, you know, commented, you know, said something cheeky to me. And it was just really interesting. But, you know, one in four men, I think, said they'd be willing to have sex with a robot in the next 50 years. So, you know, as creepy as we think this is, it's not beyond the pale in terms of what technology may bring about in the years to come.
What percentage of women?
You know, I don't think they were surveyed. But there are male robots, as we said. And my question was, and the genitals are detachable, and I asked if they were dishwasher safe. And we couldn't put that in because it's sort of a family show.
Yeah, people wash their dishes by hand these days.
Well, that's... I'm not touching that.
We're almost out of time. You became the first woman to anchor a major nightly newscast in 2006. Things have remained slow and gradual since then. Do you think the Me Too revelations of the last few months are changing that in a bigger way?
I do. I think this is truly a watershed moment. I think it will be interesting to see how companies respond and to see what policies are put in place, both written and sort of culturally. I think this is a long overdue course correction for how women are treated in the workplace. And I think what hasn't gotten that much attention is sort of the subtle sexism that I think women experience on a regular basis, kind of devalued, not sort of appreciated. There was an expression called heap heating, which of course is when a woman has an idea And everyone's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. The man at the table comes out with the idea, and everyone's like, that's brilliant, brilliant. And, you know, I think that I'm certainly more conscious about these sort of subtle signs of sexism. I'm on a number of boards, and I notice that when women speak up, they say, you know, this may not be a good idea. I'm just throwing this out here, and I don't know if this is even makes sense. And they apologize before. I never hear a man doing that. So I think some of it is also incumbent on women to also be more confident and strong in the workplace and have agency, as my daughters would say.
Do you think it might have meant anything to the 2016 campaign that so many men controlling the national campaign media narrative turned out to be harassing or otherwise behaving inappropriately toward women while the potential first woman president was running? Charlie Rose, Mark Halperin, John Hockenberry, Ryan Lizza, Tavis Smiley, I could go on. They all lost their jobs, but later. Do you ever ask yourself if there's a relationship?
Oh, well, I think we all are products of our cultural conditioning. And I know when I was the anchor and managing editor of the CBS Evening News, I often called writers and producers out for framing things which I in a sexist way. And one of the most gratifying parts of that job for me was to be able to draw attention to stories that I think my male counterparts were not particularly interested in, like sexual assault in the military or dating violence and all kinds of stories like that. That's why diversity is so critically important in media and in all workplaces, because you bring such a diversity of ideas, perspectives, and points of view. So yes, I do think it's significant, because I think, again, it's that very subtle, insidious sexism that I think creeps into the coverage. And I think it's definitely noteworthy and something that needs to be remedied by having more women and more people of color in these powerful positions of authority in this country.
Katie Couric's current series on the National Geographic Channel, for which she is correspondent and executive producer, is America Inside Out. The final episode, The Age of Outrage, airs tomorrow. Thank you so much for coming to the Green Space.
Thanks, Brian. Thank you.